Hi, everyone. This is Gary, and we have a very special guest tonight. First of all, let me start with our primary contact of this guest, and that's John Hard, who many of you know from being in base camp and from events. He's just a good man and a good friend, and we have his father on this campfire conversation. And I can tell you that this is one son who is very proud of his father. By the way, he talks about him. And so, one, I'm just thrilled to talk with this man whom a good friend of mine is so proud of because it's his father. And John Hard Sr., who we're talking to tonight, has a remarkable story. What he has lived through and the way he has lived, we all need to hear as we're trying to live well in our own life and walk through the experiences that we encounter. So, John, thank you so much for being with us. We are thrilled you're with us. Can't wait to hear your story. And so, John Jr., thank you for arranging this. And Jeff, thank you for doing this. And Jeff, I'm going to let you start.
Okay. Well, you know, I just want to start with how this whole thing started. It was when John Hard Jr. sent us a YouTube of his dad, and a B-17 had flown into his hometown, and they gave him a ride in it. And that was when I first learned that John's dad flew B-17s, and I could not believe it. And it was that day I went to the bookstore, and I'm in the news section, and I come across this book about B-17s in Europe. It's called To Kingdom Come. And I buy the book. I just knew it was the right thing to do. And when I started to read about what these guys experienced in Europe over Germany in B-17s, I could not believe it. I had seen the movie Memphis Belle, and of course I know a lot about the war and everything, but not as much about the air war over Europe. And so they brought to light what these boys experienced as they became men over Europe. And I had to talk to John Hard Sr. So I asked John Jr. to give me a phone number, which I got. And after talking with John Sr. for about 5 minutes, I knew we had to do a podcast. This is living history. I could not believe his stories. And so, yeah, I would like to echo my thanks for being here, John. And I would like to ask you to start out with, where were you when December 7th, 1941 happened?
I was at Urbana, Illinois, the home of the University of Illinois. I was a freshman at the university at that time, and we were very poor. I was up there on a scholarship, and I had a meal job. That is, I washed dishes in a girls' independent house and was given my meals as payment for washing dishes. And on December the 7th, 1941, I was standing there with the other fellow. There were always two of us, one washing and one drying. And a young girl who was from Hawaii came into the kitchen crying, saying that the Japanese had just bombed Pearl Harbor. Now, to show you some extent of my sophistication at that time, I turned to my friend and said, "What's Pearl Harbor?" And I didn't have any idea what she was talking about. But before the day was over, I became thoroughly aware of the significance of this.
So, John, let me ask you this question.
Sure.
This might be important. Were you in pre-med at this time?
Yes, I was.
You were. Okay. So that interests me. And how long was it before you actually enlisted?
I went ahead and finished out that year.
Okay.
And then during the summer, I drove to an Army Air Force primary flight base where they had a place that you could enlist, and I took all of my written exams and physical exams and was sworn in at that time. But it was several months before I was called up. I actually got called up, as I remember, late in January of 1944? Anyway, doesn't matter.
Okay. So were you 19 at that point?
Yes.
Okay, and so my question would be next, how did you get selected to fly? I pulled up the qualifications for a B-17 pilot in World War II, and they were exceptional flying skills and superior leadership qualities.
That's the Air Force talking.
Okay, so had you ever flown a plane before?
Well, not until I went into cadet training. And, of course, that took almost a year. There's a primary, there's pre-flight, primary, basic, and advanced. And each station you move into a larger, more complicated plane. And then when I graduated and got my commission and my wings, then I was made a second lieutenant. Then I was sent to a base in Tampa, Florida, and my entire graduating class, every one of us, were assigned as co-pilots in B-17s.
Wow.
And that was the last thing in the world I wanted, because I had wanted to fly fighter planes all the way through cadets. And
right.
Every time they would ask what we wanted to do,
right.
I'd put down I wanted to be a P-51 pilot. But anyway,
right,
after
and that's the way it is with everybody, right, John?
That's
everybody wants to be the fighter pilot.
Yeah.
One time they asked Chuck Yeager what he thought of airline pilots, and Chuck said, "Well, somebody's got to do it."
That's right.
So yeah, everybody wants to be the fighter pilot.
Yeah.
Okay, so you get selected for B-17s. Have never flown one before.
Right.
Could you tell me a little bit about your training?
Well, we spent 3 months there in Tampa. And flying every day, and then and a lot of nights, we flew cross countries. And by the time we had finished that, I was thoroughly versed with the B-17 and felt comfortable flying it. And then we got our orders to fly to England. Mm-hmm. And so we, in fact, we first went over to Georgia, and I've forgotten the air base there, but picked up a brand new B-17 and flew it up the East Coast and on then across the ocean, and until we got landed in England. And I was assigned to the 100th Bomb Group, which was affectionately known as the Bloody 100th.
Right.
Right.
So we're gonna get into that. But for everybody out there listening, the B-17, as you know, was a four-engine bomber. But not only was it four-engine, but it was a tail dragger, which
yes.
increases the difficulty of flying it. I don't know too many four-engine tail dragger pilots still alive today. Let's put it that way.
Well, that's just because we're all so old. We've died in old age.
Yeah. Now, a single-engine tail dragger is a very difficult airplane to fly. Four-engine tail dragger, I could not imagine that. And so, John, were you able to actually, when you taxied, were you able to see straight out? Or did you have to taxi from side to side to see past the nose?
We did what we called S curves.
Yeah.
We taxied in an S pattern. And because you could not see over the nose of the plane with sufficient clarity to just taxi straight.
Wow. So you got a monster there. You got a 65,000-pound airplane, four engines, 1,200 power right engines, radial engines,
right.
If I'm correct. And so what was that baby like in a crosswind?
You hoped you didn't have to take off and land in too severe a crosswind, but occasionally we did. But it was difficult, and you kept that low wing down. That is the one on the side of the from which the wind was coming, and that helped stabilize things, and it also helped keep it from blowing you off the runway. But that was not a major problem to deal with. It just didn't happen that often.
Yeah, good. Okay, so you get to England. Now, the way I hear it, on some missions, the fighters or the bombers would go out and come home, and there would be 600 empty beds, 600 guys that didn't come back. I've heard numbers like that. And the way I understand it was you got to England, and they gave you a bunk from somebody that had not come home from a mission 2 days ago. Is that right?
That is true.
How did that feel? I mean, you're 19 years old, right?
Yeah. Yeah, but that time I was 20.
Oh, okay.
I flew my final mission the day before my 21st birthday.
Unbelievable.
And,
which, by the way, guys, was 35 missions.
That's
To fly 25 missions back in the day, one in four guys, you know, your chances were one in four.
Well, they didn't have the fighter escort that we did, because by the time I got there, we had P-51s and P-47s. And,
okay.
So we had the advantage of fighter escorts that the earlier pilots did not have.
John, let me ask you, when was it that you were informed of the riskiness of doing this? I mean, when did you really know, when it really hit home, that this your chances of survival were probably small, looking at the past experience?
Well, in the first place, I was never informed. They didn't talk about it. But I discovered on my own on the fifth mission that I flew, which was on December the 31st, 1944.
And what was that like? I mean, what happened in you? Yeah, what was going on?
That was a mission to Hamburg.
Oh, gosh.
And when I went into briefing that morning with the rest of all of the crews, they always had a big curtain over the map that they were going to show us. And when they pulled that curtain back, I breathed a sigh of relief, because the string from our base to the target was entirely over the North Sea. So we would be flying over the ocean all the way up there, which meant there would be no anti-aircraft fire, and we would have a maybe 50-mile or 50- or 60-mile bomb run, which would be over land, but then we would get back out over the ocean again, and no anti-aircraft fire. And on other missions deep into Germany, we'd have anti-aircraft fire all the way in and all the way out. So we thought this will be what we called a milk run, that just no problem to it at all. Well, we couldn't have been more wrong, because in the first place, and you have to remember that weather reporting back in those days was in its infancy. And we got to altitude, and after flying maybe for an hour or so, our navigator informed us that we were riding a tailwind of more than 100 miles an hour.
Wow.
And so that took us into the target very rapidly. But coming back, we were facing that headwind, and which slowed our ground speed down to about 80 or 90 miles an hour. And so the weather conditions were very difficult in terms of what the headwind and tailwind was doing to us.
Okay, so John, what was the target going into Hamburg? Do you remember?
Oil refineries.
And could you tell us a little bit about what that was like going over Hamburg that first time?
Well, it was a nightmare. In the first place, as we had flown up above Hamburg a little bit and turned back, the anti-aircraft fire was just absolutely incredible. And before we ever got to the target, the number two engine, the one on, that's the inboard on the left, had been completely shot out and was not working. The number three engine, the one on the right inboard, also was badly damaged, but I was finally able to get it running well enough that I could keep the propeller just above idle so that it wasn't a drag, but it wasn't really giving us any propulsive power either. Excuse me. And but as we started into the target, the anti-aircraft fire was just the most incredible I had ever seen. The sky was just absolutely black with it. And our aileron controls were shot away. We had, well, when we got back, we had well over 100 big holes throughout the plane.
So John, the damage that you took, so that was from the enemy fighters, not from so much flak then, right?
Oh, that part of it was from flak, from that.
Okay.
But then after we got away from the target, then here came the fighters. And we had, as I recall, five waves of them with four planes in each wave. And they put bullet holes everywhere, shot out our plexiglass nose. And but again, not one of the bullets or the anti-aircraft fire either hit a single member of the crew.
Wow.
And in our 35 missions, we did not pick up a single Purple Heart. Not one member of the crew was ever injured in battle in any way.
Yeah, and that's like statistically impossible. Almost.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But the plane itself was, in fact, when we got back, they junked the airplane. It never did fly again. It was that badly shot out. And
hey, were you able to release your bombs on that run?
Yes, we were. But as I recall, probably over some farmer's potato patch.
Yeah.
We just wanted to get rid of them. We weren't a bit concerned what they were going to hit.
Okay, so if I'm hearing this right, you went back to England on two engines with a 100-mile-an-hour headwind?
That is, no, going back, we had the tailwind.
Oh, okay. Okay.
And we had that headwind going up.
Okay, all right. Wow, that helped.
No, I'm saying it backwards. I'm saying it back. We went up with the tailwind, and we were facing the headwind coming back. So our ground speed coming back was probably between 80 and 90 miles an hour.
Wow.
It took a long time to get back. And
yeah.
In fact, the rest of the bomb squadron, bomb group, had already gone on in, and we found out that they had put us down as missing in action when we got back. Because they didn't know what had happened to us.
Right. Do you remember how much of the fleet was lost that day?
We lost 12 planes out of 36.
Wow.
So,
that was one full squadron.
So, John, what was going on in you as you're taking this flight? I mean, all of this is happening. The flak, the fighters that are coming, where are you at? What's going on with you? Are you fearful? Are you so focused you're not even thinking about it? What was your experience like?
Well, there was some fear there without any question. But again, this was to be expected. We knew as bomber crews that people were going to be shooting at us, and that every mission you would have a good chance of not coming back from it. But everybody else was exactly in the same boat, and so you didn't feel like you were being unfairly treated in any way at all. This was war,
mm-hmm.
So you just expected it to be like that.
Okay, so John, I just finished 12 O'Clock High with Gregory Peck.
Yes.
That's a long movie. And he's sitting there talking to all the guys in the briefing room, and he's going, listen, just consider yourselves dead. It'll be a lot easier if you just work that way.
Yeah.
So I want to ask you, what was it like knowing that tomorrow might be your last day? Did you become fully alive and enjoy things more, or did you sort of try to deaden your heart to just get through this?
Well,
and I say this, let me just say this to all the guys out there. This is something I learned through reading the book. Lots of men, when they got back from a battle where they sustained heavy losses, really literally broke down. A lot of them just medicaled right out from the experience. So that question to you, John.
Well, when I got back from that Hamburg mission, which was my fifth mission, December the 31st, there was a letter on my bunk from my mother. And she was just telling me about everything at home. But she put a P.S. on the letter saying, read the 121st Psalm. Well, Mom and Dad had given me a Bible. In fact, they had sent it to me after I got in service. But I don't think that I had ever, up to this point, had ever taken it out of my locker. I carried it with me from one move to another, but I never bothered to read it. But when I got this letter from her and she said, read the 121st Psalm, I did. And I'm sure most of you are familiar with it, but it won't hurt to hear it again.
We'd love to hear it, John. Would you read it for us?
I will lift up mine eyes unto the hills, from whence cometh my help. My help cometh from the Lord, which made heaven and earth. He will not suffer thy foot to be moved. He that keepeth thee will not slumber. Behold, he that keepeth Israel shall neither slumber nor sleep. The Lord is thy keeper. The Lord is thy shade upon thy right hand. The sun shall not smite thee by day, nor the moon by night. The Lord shall preserve thee from all evil. He shall preserve thy soul. The Lord shall preserve thy going out and thy coming in from this time forth and even forevermore. And when I read that last verse, I went back and read it again. The Lord shall preserve thy going out and thy coming in from this time forth and even forevermore. And I just had the greatest sense of peace come over me as I read that, because I honestly felt like that God was telling me that he was going to be with me through all these visions as I going out and coming back in.
Wow.
And that I was going to be all right. Now, this didn't keep me from being scared on future missions. But I really did feel from that moment on that God had told me that I was going to get through my missions.
Wow.
And
you know, John, that's a beautiful story.
And, but that is exactly the effect that chapter of the Bible had on me. And in fact, this was reinforced. Now, up to that point, I had not taken advantage of it. But they had told us as we started that the chaplain would be available for anybody that wanted to, after a briefing, before they would take off, that they could go have a session with the chaplain. And up to that point, I had not bothered to do it. But I decided that I wanted to meet with him after that. And my belief in immortality was improved greatly when about the second or third visit, he opened his Bible and read the 121st Psalm.
Wow. Wow.
And so that really had a big impression on me.
Wow.
And One other thing that I found was very helpful to me on these missions. As I mentioned to you, I went into B-17s as a co-pilot. About halfway through the missions, I was checked out to be a pilot to take over another crew. But before I could take that crew over, they got shot down.
I understand that you asked for a few days leave, right? And
that's
they
right.
granted that to you. And while you were on leave, they were shot down.
That is true.
Wow.
And so we had two first pilots on our crew. But I liked flying from the right seat instead of the left because we flew what was called deputy lead. And this meant that I flew the bomb runs because I would slide to the left. We flew right underneath the lead ship. And when we turn on the bomb run, I and my two wingmen would slide over to the left so that the bombs didn't drop on us. But in my position in the right seat, it was much better for me to be flying than it was for Angus, my left seat pilot. But I learned very quickly that those bomb runs went a lot better if I sang all the way down them. And I sang, "God will take care of you." And I'd sing that song all the way on the bomb run.
Really?
Yes. And it gave me a great sense of relief just reminding myself that God will take care of you.
And how did your crew respond to you doing that?
They had no idea that I was doing it.
It's too loud in the airplane.
The
they can't hear it. 17,
you can't imagine, if you've never flown in one, how loud it is. There's no insulation on them whatsoever. Four engines, two or three of the windows in them are always open. They never close. So it was impossible to carry on a conversation in a B-17 except over the radio, the intercom. Mm. Well, I didn't turn my intercom on. I just sat there and sang. And so nobody had the least idea that I was singing, "God will take care of you."
Huh. That's amazing.
Hey, John, I just have a couple quick questions that I would just like cleared up in my own mind. When you got close to the bomb run, did you have the Norden bomb sights on your B-17s?
Yes.
Okay, did they actually take over? Did they bring you over the target? Were they navigating at a certain point?
Once you turn onto the bomb run, and bomb runs were anywhere from 50 to 90 miles long, but the navigator took over the flying of the plane with that Norden bomb sight. And he flew it, but the minute that the bombs would drop, then I would take back over again and get away from the target as quickly as I could.
Okay, so how are you guys navigating up there? I mean, it's not like they had navigational sites for you guys to fix in on. So what was the primary method for navigation? Because these bombardiers needed to know the speed of the airplane, the wind direction, and all that. How did you navigate?
The navigator sat at a table in the nose of the plane, and the bombardier was right up in the nose. But the navigator had an overhead bulbous light that, or glass that, to look through that he could take readings for flying at night. But he would just strictly do it by what was known as dead reckoning.
Right.
And he'd know the speed we were flying, the ground speed that we were attaining, and the directions that we were flying. Of course, he had all the maps that of Europe laying right there in front of him. So a good navigator knew where you were every minute.
Yeah. I mean, so must be using a slide ruler, basically, right?
Just, absolutely.
Just plotting your chart along. That's incredible.
Yeah.
All right, hey, here's another question I've got for you. If the aircraft didn't have any insulation and you had a couple open windows, you would often take those things up to, what, 19, 20,000 feet?
35.
Well, how cold did it get in there?
It would get down to about easily 50 below, and on one or two occasions it got down to 70 below.
Okay, so how high could the German fighters actually go?
They could get right up there with us.
Oh, my gosh. Could you imagine that, guys, for everybody listening?
You also have to remember how I dressed for a mission. I would get out of bed, and I'd put on long underwear, and I would put on two pair of socks. And then I would put my woolen olive drab uniform on top of that long underwear. And then I would put an electrically heated flying suit on top of that I could plug into the plane that would put some heat into it. And then on top of that, I would wear one of these big heavy leather with fur trimmed flying suit on top of that. And I would have on two pair of gloves. I would have a helmet on, the oxygen mask, and goggles, so there was not an inch of exposed skin anywhere. But even with all of those layers of clothing and an electrically heated suit, I still got cold.
I'll bet you did.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll tell you what, I'm not going to complain about the air conditioning up too high next time I have a commercial flight.
Good for you.
hey, John, here's a question from Bob Kane, who is listening, and he asked this. He said, did your missions ever get to the point where you had eliminated a lot of the unknowns to the point that you were less afraid of what you were going to face?
That we were what now?
Well, did you ever have any missions where you could eliminate a lot of the unknowns of what you were going to encounter?
No.
To the point that you weren't that afraid anymore?
Well, no. Once you were in anti-aircraft fire or flak or fighters, you were scared. You'd be an idiot not to be scared. And I was just as scared at the end of my tour as I was at the beginning of it. Because one day we were flying along, and I happened to look out the window, and here was this fighter pilot just right outside my window. And when I first glanced at it, I thought it's a P-51. Then I did a double take and realized it was a German ME-109. And just as I realized that, he banked in towards us, and I could see his cannon pumping as he fired. About that time, felt a terrible cold blast of air. He had shot out our plexiglass nose. And again, at 30,000 feet or wherever we were, with temperatures 50 to 70 below zero, it was cold. And that was some wind that whipped back through there that day. But we made it back just fine. Incidentally, our gunners did, as he went underneath us, they shot him down.
Oh.
So his firing at us was the last thing he ever did.
So John, let me ask you. You get back from a mission. You had many of them, 35.
Yeah.
Typically, what would happen after a mission? Would you guys get together and talk, or would there be more just silence? Everybody would kind of go off?
No, the very... main thing that happened was we would have what was called debriefing, and the members of the intelligence department at the base would sit down with each crew and have them describe everything that happened to us and when and where it happened and that sort of thing. And one of the first things I realized when you get back from a mission and you walk into that room, they hand you a shot of whiskey. Well, I grew up with very religious parents who were teetotalers, and I just grew up without drinking. And so as we started those missions, I would always hand off my shot of whiskey to one of the other crew members. After Hamburg, when they handed it to me, I gulped it down. And from that time on, I drank my scotch or bourbon, whichever they gave us, after every mission. So that was the start of my drinking days.
You know, so many of those movies we see, everybody smoking, and apparently they took that up just to calm their nerves from everything they were doing.
Almost everybody smoked back then.
Right.
For some reason, I did not. But all the other crew members, I think every one of them. And as soon as we would get down under 10,000 feet so that we weren't breathing oxygen, everybody except me would light up. And almost everybody smoked back then.
Yeah. Hey, one quick question, and this is, again, this is totally for me. Did the Germans actually throw smoke out over the target sites when you guys went over it?
Yes.
How did they do that? Was it smoke bombs or?
Yeah, smoke bombs.
Yeah, they were. Okay.
Anything to try to obscure the target or make it more difficult to. And again, this was not done at every place, but we did see that quite a bit.
Okay, now we got a couple more questions for you, but we'd love to get into what happened to your life, because when you came back from the service, you, as a four-engine pilot, are a poster child for the airlines. They would have loved to have picked you up. And why did you not go into the airlines after that?
Well, my first thought on getting back was to go with the airlines. But I discovered that the only airline at that time that really was hiring new discharged pilots was Pan American, and they don't even exist anymore. But all of their, if you went with the Pan American, they immediately sent you to South America.
Right.
Well, I'd spent the last several months in Europe, and I had gotten married while I was in service. And the last thing in the world I wanted to do was go to South America. So I turned that down immediately and went back home and bought a grocery store.
Well, okay, so for everybody listening, you're about to enter into the golden age of aviation. He's offered what would be the best company flying at that time, which is Pan American. Even though he's going to have to take some time down in South America, that's who you want to work for. You know, you'd have retired a pretty good, you know, 747 pilot out of Kennedy or something like that.
Right.
You know, had you taken the job. And but you didn't take that. So you come out of the service with all this experience and all this training, yet you don't go into that field. What do you wind up doing? You buy a grocery store, and what happens after that?
Well, I was in pre-med when the war started. But after I got into that grocery store, a year or so later, in fact, my father had moved to where we lived, and he was in the grocery store with me. And then my wife had our first baby, which was John's older brother. His name was Stephen. And when she had gone past her due date, and her doctor that was going to deliver the baby also was a surgeon, and he loved to do C-sections. So he told me that day, he said, I need to do a C-section on her. And I didn't know any better, so I said, okay, do it. And as he got ready, he turned to me and he said, would you like to come in and watch? And I said, yes, I would. So they did it under spinal anesthetic. She was awake. I stood there at the by her head and, in fact, held her hand. But as I watched him do that, I thought, I've got to do that someday. And that reborned the desire to become a physician.
Wow.
And I never did lose that desire. And after a couple of years, I was able to dispose of the store. And we moved to St. Louis, and I went to Washington University then.
Wow. Okay, so Gary, you know, I just teed the ball up for you, okay? Drive that one right down the course now. Come on, man. What do we do with calling on that, right?
Yeah, I mean, here's what I'm so fascinated by, John, is that you had this fascination, this desire with medical practice in the beginning. You were pre-med. You went through all this during the war, your time there, and yet it just took seeing and experiencing this surgery take place that it reignites in you. Like you said, it was kind of born again inside of you again.
That's right.
And you pursue it, which many men don't do. Something occurs to them, right? They see something, they remember this is what they love, but they never have the courage or at least maybe the tenacity to go after it. And yet you did that. Was there any preparation or anything that was important that you went through during the war that lent itself with when you were a surgeon?
No. Can't think of anything at all because my whole military experience was in preparation for flying combat and then
mm-hmm.
flying combat. And as soon as I had finished my missions, the war was getting over, and I was one of the earliest to be discharged because I had completed all my missions. I had the points. And so I was back home as a civilian when the war ended in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay, so John, let me ask you this then: did the being around that much trauma and that much excitement and that much of an emergency, did that help you becoming a doctor?
I don't think so. As I say, we did not have a single member of our crew get a Purple
yeah.
Heart.
Right.
So while I saw a lot of planes being shot down, and our immediate group, we saw no injuries or anything else that would influence me. Seeing
okay.
my oldest son born was what reignited the desire to become a physician.
So let me ask you, so did John Jr., was he born by cesarean or?
Yes.
Okay. That tells us some things about him. That's good to hear. Okay.
Does that tell you why he's the way he is?
Oh, it explains everything now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so do we have Don Hart Jr. On the host line right now?
Yes, he is.
Hey, John, how many people have told you in your life that your dad has saved their life as a physician?
Oh, between 10 and 20,000.
And
wow.
So what is that like, John? Because most of us don't have that experience of hearing other people talk about our dad and the effect that he has had on them.
For me?
Yes.
Well, you know, you just grow up knowing that your dad really is a great man, and it gives you quite an example to follow. In some ways, it's almost a challenge because you feel like you've got to measure up to that level.
Well, John worked in hospitals.
As an orderly?
Mm-hmm.
A lot during those early years, his teenage years. And so he got to see a lot of medicines
mm-hmm.
back in those days.
Hey, John,
he had no desire to do it.
John Jr., could you move a little bit farther away from your dad, because you're both getting echoes from each other.
Yeah.
So keep going. I want to hear more about this. So John Jr., you were around the hospital a lot because of your dad.
Yeah, I worked
and,
as
and
a...
And therefore you became an accountant.
That's right.
I know.
No, the thing that affected me most was 1 o'clock in the morning, hearing the phone ring, and then my dad leaves to go do surgery all night. Mm-hmm. And I said, I don't want to be a doctor.
So instead of having a few nights that are late, you've just chosen to have January through April 15th.
Yeah, three months.
Yeah, we're out all the time.
That's right.
Hey, John Sr., we just got to say this. We've got 10 minutes left. What a legendary life you have lived.
Yeah.
And we really do want to salute you in what you did. And you're 87 years old now, is that right?
Yes, that's right.
Hey, Gary, would you unmute my dad there on that 928? I'd like to have him say hello to John Hart. He's 87 years old. He was a bombardier on a PBY-2Y-5 in the Pacific.
That?
And he flew the Norden bomb site, and he went on to become an airline pilot after the war. And he flew everything from DC-3s to DC-10s.
Great.
And, is he on there,
no,
Gary?
No, actually, Jeff, he must have dropped off just a little bit ago, so he's not on here anymore.
He did. Oh, okay.
You tell him that I really envy him, because I really did want to be a commercial pilot. But it just was not to be.
Oh, I'm sorry. He was on most of the call, and I would love to have had him say hello to you there. And I'm sure he would have added a few stories in there.
So, John Sr., does it feel like you led two different lives? I mean, as far as an adult, you had your military experience, and then you had your medical experience. Or does it not feel like two separate lives?
No, not at all.
Okay.
Not at all. And I still want to emphasize, I think, probably the single most important time of my life was the night or the evening that I got back from the mission. And that letter from Mom told me to read the 121st Psalm, because reading that really turned my life around. And from that time on, I really felt like that God was protecting me, that he had told me that I would be protected for the remainder of my missions, the rest of my life. And reading that chapter turned my life around completely. And it's always been so important to me since then.
You know what, that chapter, those verses will have a different place in my heart now that I've heard you tell the story.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Having read it this morning, knowing that these guys were reading that before a mission, that these are the ancient foundations of all the saints that have gone before us, reading the same thing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We are built on a great foundation.
Have you... Are any of your flying buddies, the guys that you did these missions with, are they still around? Are they still alive? Are you in contact with them?
I've only been able to maintain contact with a couple of them, and I haven't even been able to be in contact with them for a couple of years. So I'm pretty sure that some of them are still alive, but I do not know which one of them maybe passed on.
Okay. Jonathan Poole, who's listening, asked this question. He said, was there a level of letdown for you after flying? In other words, life just wasn't at that high level of excitement and risk after that. Was that a letdown for you to go into kind of ordinary life?
Not in the least. as I say, I had gotten married, came home and to my wife, and started a career, and I continued to fly some as a civilian in small planes for a few years after that. So there was no letdown at all.
Okay.
He just went into a new level of warfare, where when he came home, he just couldn't see the bullets that he could see when he was in over Europe. Now the bullets were flying, but he couldn't see them, you know.
You've got it so right.
And he created a little crew after a while. Now they're all grown up.
That's right.
But I tell you, I'm sitting here in my little makeshift office at home and looking at the wall opposite, in which is a large picture of a B-17 cockpit. And I get to sit here and look at that cockpit every day and remember the pleasures and joys of flying that airplane.
Hey John, it looked to me when I was watching the Memphis Belle, it's been a while since I've been in a B-17, that they had just a left and right throttle. It seemed like it overrode. But what happened if you wanted to feather one of the engines on either side? And you had two throttles. Would you just have a feather button for each propeller?
You did have a feather button for each. But now, there were actually six throttle levers that came up.
Oh, okay.
And four of them were together in the lower position. And you could hold all four of them in your hand at one time and make minor adjustments that you needed to. When you were on the ground taxiing, there were two throttles for the outboard motors sticking up above those, and you use those to taxi with.
Okay. Oh, okay.
So
you
had six throttles sitting there in front of you.
Yeah. Well, I tell you, one of the most coolest man-made things that ever we created as men is a cockpit. I don't know what it is about that, but right, I just love hanging out up there. Right?
Yeah,
it's just such a masculine environment. You got a great view up there.
That's
sort of in control. The door's closed. Nobody really knows what's going on up there, and it's where all the best jokes are told. Right up there. And So I totally agree. Hey, we got a question online, and it's from Jonathan Poole, and he wanted to know about what your recent experience was like in the B-17 when you got to fly it in your hometown just recently. What did it feel like?
Oh, it was wonderful. They had a B-17 flying here a few weeks ago, and I had gone out and looked at it. It was back in the radio shack area there, and the pilots came walking. I had introduced myself to them earlier and told them I had been a B-17 pilot, and they came through with a group of ladies, and they said, "We're going to take these ladies up for a flight." They were all with communications of some sort, and he turned to me and he said, "Would you like to come along?" And I said, "I certainly would." And so I went out, but I stayed back in the radio compartment. It's the only time I ever rode in a B-17 that I was not in the cockpit, but I enjoyed it thoroughly.
Yeah, those ladies weren't communications ladies. They were just ladies.
That's right.
And that's what every guy wants to do, is get a hold of a B-17 and then just fill it up with a bunch of ladies and take them out for a ride, right?
Okay, so the other question Jeff on there, David was asking, what's the fastest airspeed that you remember ever hitting?
150 miles an hour.
Okay.
Yeah, that was a normal cruise.
That was our normal cruise.
Yeah.
Actually, in a dive, I've seen our airspeed go up to 200, but we just flew at 150 miles an hour indicated all the time. Now, at altitude, your true airspeed would be 200 miles an hour, but on the dashboard there, instrument panel, it showed 150 miles an hour. And that's what, to me, a B-17 flew at all the time.
Yeah.
Right. So the fastest it would go at altitude, I was reading, was 287. So that would be true airspeed.
Yes.
So he's indicating much less than that, but your true airspeed, because there's less wind or air up there, he's traveling faster. So it would be 280, and then it would be plus or minus whatever the wind was.
Yes.
So, you know, that would give you an idea once you're at your optimum altitude.
That is correct.
So, John, let me ask you, if somebody were to ask you, no, I'll ask you. I'm just going to flat out ask you. What are, because of all that you have lived through, all that you have done, the life you've lived, what would you say are the three most important things to know?
That's kind of difficult to just come off the top of my hat, but to me, certainly the number one most important thing to know is that we're children of God, that God loves us, and that God will take care of us. And without any question, I think my whole life has been based on that. After that time when I read the 121st Psalm and began to feel God's presence and the cockpit with me on every mission. And I've never lost that feeling.
Mm. Yeah.
Wow.
And I'm guessing in your medical practice as a surgeon, was there also that same experience of sensing God is here?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I prayed before surgery, and or whenever a patient was critically ill, I always depended on faith in God, not only to get the patient through, but to get me through.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
I lost some patients that were awfully, awfully difficult.
So in one sense, you've seen more death up close as a surgeon than you had in the military.
Oh, yes, yes. Yeah, and in the military, I never did see any up close.
Right.
I saw them coming off of other planes and being brought off on stretchers and things like that, but maybe 100 yards away from me. And
yeah. Huh. Okay. Well, Jeff?
Yeah. Hey, John, we're looking at your picture online that was sent in, and you're with your squadron, and you are one handsome guy on there.
Bless you.
You are one good-looking guy. We're watching
you must
it,
be
it,
looking at the ball turret gunner.
And you know, what an amazing time period that you were given to live in. And I want to ask you, have you ever been up to the World War II Memorial up in Washington, D.C.?
John, help me answer that. John went with me to Washington, D.C. As I told you early on, my memory is terrible, but he says, yes, we did. And in fact, I remember now. That's the one with all of the stations around it. Yes,
right.
John and
right.
I spent the day up there.
Right. You know, I took my dad up there, and it was a two-hour drive, and it was just some normal conversation. I was actually really enjoying being with my dad. But when he hit the ground at the actual memorial, he seemed to just come alive. And
yeah.
He's going, I was in that battle. I was in that battle. And then he's going over to every veteran that looked like a guy that was a veteran. He'd go, were you in the war? Where were you? And he just seemed to come alive.
Well, I can imagine.
Yeah, hearing that. So, Well, I'll tell you one trip I would love to make with you, and that would be to go back to England to some of those old airfields, you know, and just walk those a little bit, you know.
The Thorpe Abbott base where we were based, I think there is still a runway there, but it is a memorial. They've never used that for anything else except it's just a memorial to the 100th Bomb Group.
Wow.
John, I want to tell you personally that your son, John, is a remarkable man.
Oh, I know that. I appreciate you saying it.
Yeah, I know you know that. I just want you to know that he has touched many of us. We love to be around him, and the wisdom that he contains inside of him from, you know, what he's lived and what he's studied and his kindness. He is a good man. You have raised a good man, and we're grateful for that.
I depend on his intelligence and goodness very much myself.
Yeah. So thank you for what you've given us through him, and thank you for what you've given us through this time on the phone. It's been great.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure talking to you, and I hope I didn't bore you too much.
No, not at all. Not at all. Hey, John, I look forward to the time when I can see you face to face, and I hope that soon.
So thank you. Well, Jeff, I think he's off.